Radio Free Press, a podcast from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, campaigning for free, independent and accountable media.
It was the mother of all battles in the tumultuous 11-year reign of Margaret Thatcher, her government's all-out assault on the mine workers' union and their communities. She wanted to destroy not just the NUM, but the whole trade union movement, but the miners fought back with a year-long strike, and their communities fought with them. Two miners were killed, thousands of them and their supporters were injured, more than 10,000 were arrested and 200 jails after brutal battles with the police, for Thatcher used every arm of the state against them. It started in March 1984, just 30 years ago, and we're only now finding out just how far the government and most of the media were prepared to go. Because it was under the 30-year rule that government documents have had to be released after being kept secret for that long. And the documents show how ministers and coal board bosses lied about their plans to destroy the coal industry. There have been new revelations as well about the police tactics in the most violent confrontation of the dispute, the notorious Battle of Orgreave, when mass ranks of police attacked miners trying to stop the distribution of fuel for steelworks from a key coking plant in South Yorkshire. All this and more is in a book just out called Settling Scores, The Media, the Police and the Miners' Strike, published by the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. I'm Tim Gopsall from the CPBF, and I'm joined by the book's editor, Granville Williams, and by three other people who played key roles in these dramas of 30 years ago. First, Granville Williams, tell us, what is the main point of this book?
Well, last November, Nick Jones gave me a phone call, and he reminded me that as he was digging into the cabinet paper archives, what was in the papers. And I thought, wow, well, this could be the basis for a pamphlet. And then I thought, no, there's what's happened with the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign, what's happened with Hillsborough and the revelations about the South Yorkshire Police. And gradually, a new book. I did Shaft it for the 25th anniversary, and I thought, I don't really want to go back there, but this is all new material. All the people in it have contributed fresh and original material, and that's the basis for doing the book.
Right, now we can pick up on these stories. The revelations about the Tory government's tactics are written by Nicholas Jones, and he reported the miner strike for BBC Radio. He was an industrial and political correspondent with the BBC from 1972 to 2002. Nick, what is this new story?
Well, what's new is that we've had the cabinet records for 1984. These are Mrs. Thatcher's personal papers. They've now been released by the National Archives. And what's so important about them is that you see the documents there. For example, there's a record of a conversation in Mrs. Thatcher's room with just a handful of ministers, and she's told 6 months before the start of the strike that Ian McGregor wants to close 75 pits and he wants to make 64,000 miners redundant. This is 6 months before the strike, and as the months go on, the government actually agrees an accelerated pit closure programme. Yet, when the strike starts in the March of 1984, the government is insisting it only wants to close 20 pits and make 20,000 miners redundant, and what we see is a cover-up, we see misinformation, and we see this whole thing played out, because of course it's the Prime Minister at the very top who is authorising these campaigns against the miners' union for having lied, when actually, if you look at the cabinet documents, there it is in print, Ian McGregor saying he wants to close 75 pits, and when the union said that's what the government are doing, they were accused of lying, when the reverse is the case, as we now see, and we study those documents.
Ian McGregor, of course, was the chairman of the National
Yes.
Coal Board. Now, the union were how did the union know that what the government were going to do, and what happened when they said the right things?
Well, what had always been feared on the part of the union was that there was a secret hit list. And, of course, when the government denied it and kept denying it and kept accusing the miners' union of lying, but just think, you see, what one has to remember is if the whole of the coal industry had known that this was Ian McGregor's secret plan, and, of course, he is this American mine manager brought in to slim down the coal industry, if everyone had known that 75 pits were going to be closed, my word, it would have united the coal industry against the government. So this was crucial information. And of course, as history played out, we know that not all of the miners joined the strike. If they'd known then that their industry was going to be decimated, you can be pretty sure that this strike would have been solid from the start.
And this is just another way in which the odds were stacked against the union from the start.
Right.
And another way was the way in which Thatcher used all the arms of the state...
Yes.
To keep the miners under control.
And we see in the Cabinet papers example after example of where Mrs. Thatcher is micromanaging this whole dispute. So that within the first week, she's saying that chief constables have got to, their resolve has got to be stiffen their resolve. And what happens, literally within a week, we find that flying pickets, men who are going from the Kent coalfield to Nottinghamshire or from Yorkshire to Nottinghamshire, they're being stopped on the motorways or at the Dartford Tunnel. We have the creation almost of a national police force. And then, of course, we find these details about how Mrs. Thatcher is urging the law officers to get the magistrates dealing with people who've been arrested. So you see this whole management of this whole dispute, and the Prime Minister of the day, Mrs. Thatcher, is mobilising herself, the whole operation, in my opinion.
And the police came in to control the picket lines and to help to get miners back in through the picket lines and to attack the picket lines when they were being effective. Now, we've heard that new information has come out as well about their tactics at Orgreave. Barbara Jackson is secretary of the Orgreave Truth and Justice campaign. She took part in the miners' strike herself as a member of the white-collar section of the NUM working in an office for the coal board. Barbara, it's always been known that the police used a lot of violence in getting the trucks out of the plant. What is the campaign saying now?
Well, the campaign started 16 months ago after the Hillsborough families had had their panel hearing. And, you know, they'd been seeking truth and justice for 23 years. And we were elated that, you know, they'd finally got the truth out. And because of the BBC One Inside Out programme, Dan Johnson, where he got some police officers to go on camera and say that they were told what to write in their statements. And he had some police statements examined by an independent barrister who verified that there were lots of commonality, phrases, sentences, paragraphs. And so it was a unique opportunity. Orgreave had made us keep our heads down for years. There was never a window of opportunity to open up the issues of the strike. We were defeated industrially. When you've had all the forces of the state thrown at you, you keep your head down. But this was the window of opportunity to start a high-profile campaign and to use the events of the 18th of June at Orgreave as a silver bullet to open up the policing of the whole strike and to open up the government's management of the strike so that the blame doesn't solely lie with the police, but it lies with their political masters. And that is our aim. And it's a tremendous aim for a small grassroots campaign. But we decided we were starting 28 years late and we'd just got to be bold and to get out there and go for the ultimate, a full public inquiry, rewrite history, try for an apology from the government, get Hansard rewritten. It's not about money. It's not about compensation. It's about the truth. It's about history and memory and a public apology as
That is quite a campaign. We'll come on to where it's going to go in a minute. But another former striker is Ray Riley, who worked at Frickley Colliery in Yorkshire and was himself subjected to a brutal assault by West Yorkshire Police. He has analysed the source of the brutal tactics at Orgreave. Ray, tell us what you found.
It wasn't an aberration, as many people believed. It wasn't a one-off mass conflict involving police and striking miners. It was as cynical as it was calculated, designed to break the strike at probably its most crucial period. But there's context to this as well. And in my chapter in the book Settling Scores, I talk about the development and deployment of paramilitary policing. And you have to understand the politics of the time as well. Because during the 1970s, the Tory government had suffered two massive defeats by miners. 1972, particularly at Saltley Gates in Birmingham. And in 1974, which actually saw off the lamentable government of Ted Heath. consequently, there was a tremendous visible physical move to the right within British politics, culminating in the election in 1979 of Margaret Thatcher. In terms of this right-wing move, other sectors of the state were engaged as well, none more so than policing. Orgreave, on the 18th of June, without parliamentary knowledge, the police put into practice an array of crowd control techniques that they had imported, and the end result is probably why we're here today.
You yourself were subject to attack by the police, and you had a case against them. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that happened in November 1984, outside my own colliery, Frickley Colliery, which is in South Emsall, West Yorkshire. We got to know, probably round about tea time the day before, which was on the 12th, that people were going to scab at Frickley. So word was put out that we would be required, and there would be a big demonstration outside our own colliery to deter these men from going back to work. Suffice to say, it was a running battle throughout South Emsall. And probably about 50 metres into the colliery entrance, if we can call it that, there was probably about 200 riot coppers taking a break. I was with about 200 pickets, 300, chatting, talking about what had happened, who'd seen what, and I heard some glass smashing. Next thing I know, there was just absolutely pandemonium. Police officers were hurtling towards us. Coppers were hurtling towards us. Shields, visors, truncheons. And obviously we just legged it. And I heard one shout, "There's one. There's one." Not "there's the culprit." Not "there's the ringleader." Not "there's the guy who we saw earlier throwing stones at us." "There's one." They didn't start hitting me immediately. But within seconds, probably four or five others descended and started hitting me, kicking me, trying to grab my genitals. I remember that. I remember this copper grabbing me by the ear, pulling my head back, and then I felt as though someone had rammed my head into a concrete wall. Picked me up, dragged me through the ranks of police officers who were kicking and spitting in my face, took me back to the colliery officers, and I heard this voice say, "Lie down, lie fucking down." And because it didn't register, this copper, the sergeant, police sergeant, got up, whacked me on the arm, whacked me on the chest, and I went to my knees, and he came. I remember having a tremendous whack on the right arm, and that really hurt. That really hurt. And then when I was laid down, face down, keeping quiet, the point of the truncheon was forced down into my back. These two coppers appeared, said, "We're arresting you for a public order offence," took me to Pontefract Police Station, where I was kept 36 hours, brought before the magistrates. Draconian bail conditions were put on me, and I was on a curfew for 6 months after that.
Yeah. You brought a case against the police?
Yeah, I was acquitted at Pontefract Magistrates Court. 5 years later, at Leeds High Court, I won substantial damages against West Yorkshire Police.
Right. Great. Now listen, that is a terrible story about what the police did. But it wasn't just the government and the police who were attacking the miners. Most of the media were basically on the government side, and they resorted to some very biased reporting of the strike. They kept on repeating the government line that more and more miners were breaking the strike and going back to work, and they reported picket line battles entirely from the police point of view. Even the BBC were at it, switching its footage of the violence at Orgreave to make it look as if it started with miners attacking the police, whereas in fact it was the other way around. Granville, what does your book say about this?
Right, well, there's a very good chapter by Tony Harker, and Tony used Freedom of Information to ask the BBC for what papers they had on the actual event. And you're right, the miners tell me that they went home after Orgreave, and it was their wives who were saying, "What have you been getting up to there?" In other words, the powerful message that came across, which millions of people have seen, was exactly the reverse of the truth. Now, within the BBC, at a quite senior level, there were worries about this. How had this happened? And the idea, of course, the BBC...
They knew that they got it wrong.
Well, there was the Assistant Director General, a man called Alan Prothero, began to ask, he wanted checks done. What's going on here? What are we doing? And so what Tony does in the chapter is look at the way in which, in some ways, the BBC was trapped inevitably into reporting from the side of the police, because inevitably you saw during the strike the bias that the media was showing generated hostility from miners. So you had a trapped situation.
And what did the BBC documents show?
Well, they show that there was an agonising appraisal. There was an investigation and there was a report done on what the BBC did during that time in the strike. So Tony's chapter is, I think, a very important chapter in the way it actually shows that the BBC itself was... there was elements of disquiet about the reporting at that time.
Well, it's good to know that as well. But Nicholas Jones, you covered the strike as a BBC reporter. What is your take on the way the clashes were covered?
Well, you have to look at it, first of all, from the fact that the... And this is so important, that you see, after Mrs Thatcher mobilised the forces of the state, as we've just heard Barbara and Ray explaining, and the police began to get control, the front line moved towards the way the strike was being reported. And therefore the government was, if you like, framing the whole dispute in a way, and this was taken up by the national newspapers, which was feeding through to the BBC and to radio and television. So, for example, it became, you see, this clash as to whether the miners who wanted to work would be able to go to work. The violence was reported as a threat to democracy. We saw the way in which the steel workers were pitted against the miners, because the steel workers wanted to carry on working, wanted to save their steelworks. They were up against the miners. So these storylines were presented in that way. And they were, and this I think is the criticism of broadcasters like myself, we tended... I think, to reflect the agenda which was suiting the government, which was that it was all about the new faces, the men, as Mr. Riley has just described. He had heard of what had happened at Frickley, where men wanted to go back to work. Well, they were the heroes for the national press, and I think that the radio and television began to reflect that, and it also reflected this whole clash. It was worker against worker, miner against miner. And you can see how that played to Mrs. Thatcher's agenda of she was the one who was standing up for democracy. You can see the storylines were working to the government's favour. And as Granville Williams has just pointed out, there was this difficulty. Journalists were hated in many of the mining villages. And therefore, when the television crews went, they were filming more often than not from behind the police lines. So that added to the bias as well. And that
so
was
you
the
yourself feel that you got it wrong and that the miners were right to be hostile?
Well, I have acknowledged time and again my own soul searching on this. Did the broadcasters become the cheerleaders for the return to work? I say yes, that is what happened.
Barbara Jackson.
I'd just like to congratulate Nick on his honesty and reflection about what actually happened in the reporting. But, you know, the media played a despicable role in the... hysteria over the return to work, because it started off as a drip, and then it was a trickle, and then it was a stream, and then it was a deluge, you know, of a return to work. And they really latched onto this terminology, and they focused very intensely on the effort to get one person back at work with, you know, an armoured coach and huge police presence. Well, anybody who got any sense knew that one person returning to work wasn't going to start turning coal. So what did that person do? That person was just a symbol to demoralise the striking miners. So it didn't matter who that person was, so long as somebody returned to work. And there was no work for them to do in isolation like that. But the media really got behind that as the story. And, I mean, we used to picket our office every day for a couple of hours.
That was in Sheffield.
In Sheffield. And we used to discuss what we'd seen the night before, because it was reported daily on TV, what we'd read, what we'd heard on the radio. But we didn't recognise, you know, what was being reported. And we were shocked at the coverage.
Ray Riley, what did you feel about the reporting?
I echo what Barbara says about the biased reporting. When I got home from Orgreave on the 18th, I was incredulous, really incredulous, as to the reporting on the television. I couldn't believe that I was at the same place. There was no reporting on the military precision in which the police carried out their operations, the deliberate maiming of minor pickets. So you're left with an image of the media that did do a lot of damage to the reporting of the strike. You know, I guess in some ways we still live in that legacy.
It does seem a positive thing that at least now the truth is coming out and people are talking about it. Granville Williams, you're already the editor of two other books on the miners' strike. Tell us why it's still so important.
Well, the area I live in is in West Yorkshire, and Upton's a former mining village. So pretty much any day of the week, if I want to talk to somebody, it'll be an ex-miner. My next-door neighbour was in mining till 2 years ago. But if you look around the area and you see the way what was a prosperous, proud area with the big pubs and the activity that a mining culture sustained, it all went so badly wrong. Dereliction, drug abuse, violence, vandalism, all the things that were completely anathema to that kind of life in the villages. You looked after your own and your people, all of that began to go. And I noticed that, I witnessed that. And so in 1993, the area we're in at the moment in Leeds commissioned me to write a history of Leeds mining, remembering how it was when the last two pits in Leeds closed. And from that time on, I've been in connected with lots and lots of miners and miners' groups. And for the 25th anniversary and the 30th, I thought we needed to get the story out, not just for the older people, but for young people to be reminded of what happened.
Nicholas Jones, what do you think the lessons are from the miners' strike?
Well, I think
for the unions.
Well, the important, I think, lesson for the trade unions in today's multimedia environment. And I think this has been proved that no union would repeat the mistake of the National Union of Mine Workers. I say it was a mistake to alienate radio and television to the degree that we were alienated, that we were not welcome. Now, just think what would happen today. I think, you see, that with the advance in technology, there would be people. Ray Riley described what happened to him. He would more than likely have a camera phone. The lady who saw what he was doing would have had a camera phone. There would be images on YouTube, on Facebook. There would be a whole social media explosion. So I think that the way the dispute would be reported today, and we only have to look at the images that come in from Kiev or from the Arab uprisings, I think that the high-definition pictures we would get, the close-ups we would get of the blood on Ray Riley's face, that would be all over social media. And the important
Nick,
point
how can
is,
you blame the unions for that? For five well, minutes ago, you said that you thought the miners were justified in being suspicious of the media.
Of course I am. Of course that's exactly what I said. But the point would be, because journalists couldn't get into the pit villages, we've seen on television families saying they were sending their children to bed without any food. Now, today there would be social images of that. They would be alive with these images. And the point I'm making is that it was difficult for journalists to get in there to report the hardship. It was difficult for reporters to get close enough to be able to report what was actually happening. You challenged me. I mean, the point is that journalists were not welcome there. Journalists were not trusted because it was believed the journalists were working in line with the police. So what we have to acknowledge is that this was a divisive dispute. The question you perhaps should be asking is, do you think that the journalists had actually been corralled with the forces of the state to line up against them?
I think that may well be the case, but we don't have any representative of the state.
No.
However, we do have here Ray Riley, who was in one of those villages. What do you think of that, Ray?
There's obviously exceptions to this, but I don't know if the media really are fully learned the lessons of what happened in the miners' strike. And I say that in a spirit of like solidarity with people around this in this meeting today. But if you look at the reporting of the Occupy movement, if you look at the reporting of the student demonstrations a few years ago, to me suggests that the media hasn't fully learned the lessons yet from the miners' strike.
Well, I mean, we have to correct you straight away, because, of course, if you look at the G20 demonstration, where a newspaper vendor is pushed over by a police officer, it is the image that was taken by a visitor in London, an American who is in London, who gives this camera phone image to The Guardian, that has resulted in a policeman ending up in court. All I'm saying is that the access to more information would have allowed different images to have appeared in the media, but it was very difficult to get the sort of access that the media needed.
Barbara Jackson.
When we first met 16 months ago as a campaign, we were aware of all this history, you know, with the media, but we took a decision to work with all the media, print, radio and TV, regardless, until they gave us a reason not to work with a particular reporter or newspaper. But it's very choppy waters that you're in at times. And, I mean, I don't really know. Mining communities are very close-knit. It's very difficult for them to open up to a random journalist who would turn up and want to know your story. For 30 years now, they've been telling the stories, and they've fed up of telling the stories, and nothing seems to happen in terms of justice. And when I'm interviewed by the media, as I am from time to time, they ask me, were you at Orgreave? No, I wasn't. And you can see the level of interest going down.
But you are the secretary of the Orgreave Truth and Justice Campaign. Are we getting anywhere near the truth about that momentous event now, or justice for the miners who were attacked?
Well, the South Yorkshire Police self-referred themselves in November 2012, just after our campaign started, and absolutely nothing to do with the campaign, but largely in a reaction to the BBC One Inside Out programme and the allegations that were made there. And the IPCC are still running a scoping exercise Independent Police Complaints Commission, investigating whether to investigate. We've met with them twice and had a load of platitudes and told them in no uncertain terms that they're not dealing with this with any sense of urgency or seriousness. On the anniversary of that South Yorkshire Police referral last November, and Granville was there, we had a demonstration outside their Wakefield office. We're having another demonstration outside their Wakefield office 2 weeks today. 2 weeks tomorrow, because we're still unsatisfied with the progress that's being made. Yes, we want them to do a thorough job. Yes, it needs time to do a thorough job, but 16 months later, you know, how thorough is that job going to be? Miners are dying. Miners are getting seriously ill. Miners are getting disillusioned, and they don't believe that anything is ever going to happen for them.
It seems like there's a long way to go, but I think we should end on this question of where we're getting and what we can achieve on this 30th anniversary. Ray Riley.
Well, just one final comment on media. What you have to understand is that we, as former miners, became very disillusioned, very cynical about 1984 and what happened. But at the end of the day, I'm reminded of what Claude Colburn said, the great communist journalist, who said, never believe anything until it is officially denied.
Well, they've said so many different things. Finally, Granville Williams. Well, what are the lessons we can learn about the dispute from this book?
Well, I've got an optimistic message. If I think back to the 10th anniversary, we had two meetings in this area, and the mood was, this was just after the final round of pit closures, and the mood was grim and despondent. It isn't like that now, in my view. There's a sense that after 30 years, the Cabinet papers, the South Yorkshire Police revelations, the Hillsborough, the death of Thatcher, for goodness sake, that was even celebrated in this act. So there's, I think, a more confident mood that we're going to actually get something. It'll need political will, as with Hillsborough. It required government ministers under Labour, Andy Burnham and Alan Johnson, to back the Hillsborough inquiry, That's what we want, and I hope that in the next 12 months we're going to get movement on that, because I'll tell you one thing, I'll pay tribute to what Barbara's done. The Augury Truth and Justice campaign is a grassroots power. It really is. It's just moving, it's making waves, and I think that, backed up by some Labour MPs for the Coalfields Justice campaign, and I think we're making progress.
Thank you, Granville Williams. He's the editor of Settling Scores, the media, the police and the miners strike, published by the CPBF. We've also been talking to Barbara Jackson, the secretary of the Augury Truth and Justice campaign, former BBC reporter Nicholas Jones, and Ray Riley, former miner from Frickley Colliery. I'm Tim Gopsall from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, and this podcast has been produced by Claire Colley for the CPBF.